We're discussing a handful of the cases taken up by the conservative law firm, the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, or WILL. Founder, president, and general counsel Rick Essenberg is on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Some roadmap here for conversation. Did Dane County overstep its authority with local mask mandates? The state Supreme Court is considering WILL's challenge there. The legislature's parental bill of rights on the table and WILL expanding litigation in the area of K-12 schools. And we start with redistricting and WILL joining the legislature in appealing the state's Supreme Court's decision for electoral maps put forth by Governor Evers. How do you find a middle ground with partisan fairness and keep competitive districts? Should the U.S. Supreme Court, should SCOTUS take up the appeal? 800-642-1234. Rick Essenberg, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me this morning.
Good morning. So let's start with the state legislature versus the Wisconsin Elections Commission case, the legislature appealing the state Supreme Court's decision. And we will get to the Voting Rights Act in just a moment. But I want to explore with you core retention, because Justice Hagedorn built his opinion around this measurement of core retention, so counting the number of people who will change election districts when they vote and moving the fewest number of people as possible. Do you feel core retention satisfies the least change objective?
Well, I think it's a way of measuring the least change objective. It's not the only way. It's an aggregate measure. It applies to the whole state. So it would not pick up dramatic changes in one part of the state and could be balanced by less dramatic changes elsewhere. I think it's a tool. I also think that it's a rough tool, so that if we're looking at competing maps and they're very, very close on core retention, it's difficult to say on that number alone that one is preferable to the other on the least change measure. They more accurately say that they both complied with it. I think that one of the things that may have happened here is that the core retention became a metric which perhaps was given too much weight in assessing the least changes aspect of the maps and some of the other things that maps had to comply with. They had to be equal in population, they have to be contiguous and compact. Therein lies some of the difference between the parties in which maps would be selected. But the appeal to the Supreme Court is much more limited. That only involves the Voting Rights Act.
Well, let's talk about the Voting Rights Act, protecting the right of Black and Latino voters to elect candidates of their choice when drawing district lines. How do you think that Governor Evers' map that creates 7 majority Black districts, one more than the 2011 map, how is that worse off for representation of minority voters?
Well, so we have a tension with the Voting Rights Act. And the Voting Rights Act, as it has been interpreted, in some instances allows the government to do something that it normally cannot do, and that is to make decisions based upon race. Right? In the absence of some compulsion from the Voting Rights Act, we would normally consider it unconstitutional for the government to take race into account in drawing maps. Well, here we know that the governor took race into account in drawing maps in Milwaukee County. He deliberately spread Black voters among a greater number of districts so he could create 7 barely majority Black majority districts. So the question becomes, is that unconstitutional for the government to act in this race-based manner? It might not be if you could establish that the doing so was required by the Voting Rights Act. But the Voting Rights Act is not simply a mandate to maximize minority participation. It is a law that allows courts to remedy some particular barrier to full participation suffered by specific minority groups. In this case, the Wisconsin Supreme Court declined to find, a majority did not say, that the seventh majority district was required by the Voting Rights Act. And so the question becomes, if it was not required by the Voting Rights Act, and it seems unlikely that it could have been, because if you can draw seven districts with 50.1% of the population and still have minorities with an opportunity to elect the candidates of their choice, then there probably isn't a current barrier to participation on behalf of those voters. But given the fact that there was no finding of a Voting Rights Act violation, is it even permissible to take into race into account in drawing these districts? And that's the issue that the Supreme Court has been asked to address.
Let me reintroduce you for a moment. Rick Essenberg is here, founder and president of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. As we look at cases Will has been taking up, and as we talk about the state legislature versus the Wisconsin Elections Commission that SCOTUS could take up, before we move on here, this Supreme Court has described the harm in racial gerrymandering cases as, quote, personal and individualized. Does the legislature have standing here in that the map drawing inflicts institutional injury on the legislature?
Well, I think that the voters of Wisconsin, as a general matter, legislators or voters, have an interest in not having their government act on the basis of race without sufficient justification. Perhaps, again, as we said, a demonstrated violation of the Voting Rights Act would be justification for drawing maps based upon racial lines, but we don't believe that the governor or the other interveners who were arguing for this greater number of majority-minority maps in the Milwaukee area established a Voting Rights Act violation that could have justified this, and the Wisconsin Supreme Court never found it.
I'm sorry to jump in here, but what about packing under the Voting Rights Act? Would the risk of packing Black voters arise under a six district configuration in a way that drawing seven majority Black districts would avoid this problem?
Well, I don't think so. And you can always argue that the seventh district constituted vote dilution, right? Which is the opposite. And in fact, some of the minority legislators in Milwaukee don't like these maps because they believe that the voting power of Black citizens is diluted by them. You know, we typically think in a Voting Rights Act case that a remedy is warranted when there's some type of barrier to participation by minority voters. Because there is this barrier to participation by minority voters, courts would typically require that there be a supermajority of minority voters in a voting rights district, that there be, not 50.1% a Black voting age population, but 55%, 60%. And that makes sense if you think about it, because if there's a barrier for these folks to participate, then they need a supermajority in order to have an opportunity to elect candidates of their choice. But here, that's not what happened. The governor took the Black voting age percentage and he reduced it. He reduced it to 50.1%, and it's very difficult to argue.
So here's the thing.
The group has 50.1% that it can't elect candidates of, and can still elect candidates of its choice, then there must not be a barrier for its participation, because anybody with 50.1% could do that.
Okay, we're in crunch time here, but I do want to fit in this one question, because a Marquette University analysis found all maps would likely maintain a big Republican majority in the legislature, but the plan drawn by GOP lawmakers could give Republicans a shot at a veto-proof supermajority. Do you think Republicans pushed too far here with map proposals tilted too in favor of one party?
Well, we didn't submit maps, and one of our objectives was as follows. Going into any redistricting process, Democrats here in Wisconsin are faced with a disadvantage, and that is that their voters are more geographically concentrated. And a lot of litigation that took place in the teens was an effort by Democrats to ask courts to make up for that to draw districts in a way which essentially gerrymander in a way that would remove this natural disadvantage. I can't see that that is any less a partisan exercise than what Republicans are accused of engaging into. So we ask the court, when you draw these maps, don't even look at the partisan outcome. Don't ask the parties to calculate it. Don't take it into account. Just look and make sure that the maps are equal in participation, contiguous, compact, and adopt a least changes approach. And so when we went into the part of the litigation where maps were submitted, those were the rules of the game. I am sure that that precluded the governor from submitting the kind of maps that he really wanted to submit. And so there's something a little hollow in his claims of victory, because by the time we got to the submitting to the map stages, he's really was playing under a set of rules that he didn't want to play under. He wanted to have more freedom, I think, to make up for this natural disadvantage that Democrats have.
Let's just pause right here with Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty President Rick Essenberg explaining cases. This first case his firm is litigating and why. What questions do you have about will-related lawsuits in the area of the electoral maps appeal, as we've been talking about, K-12 education and mask restrictions, the power of a health department? How should schools handle students who want to be identified by one gender, but their parents disagree? 800-642-1234. Back in a moment with Rick Essenberg here on the Ideas Network. We're with the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, or WILL, here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Founded in 2011, it calls itself one of the largest state-based litigation centers in the country, now expanding its services, adding an attorney who will focus on legal and policy issues in Wisconsin K-12 education area. What questions do you have for the head of WILL? With no specific federal law existing about mask mandates, do public health officers have the power to enforce public health guidelines? 800-642-1234. WILL's President Rick Essenberg stays with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's move on to Becker versus Dane County, challenging the authority of the Dane County health officer in issuing emergency pandemic orders. You filed the case on behalf of 2 Dane County residents and a business in response to the emergency pandemic orders. So here's the thing. I mean, the state Supreme Court struck down Evers' mask mandate 1 year ago this month. Indoor mask mandates in Dane County expired March 1st. What is the point of still litigating this?
Well, I think that the reason that the court is still litigating is it's possible for this issue to arise in the future. And the Supreme Court is a law-developing court and has expressed an interest in clarifying what the law should be. I mean, if you look at all the COVID cases that we filed, and we filed quite a few of them, they rarely, if ever, addressed whether or not what was being done was a good policy or a bad policy. We never argued about whether there should be a mask mandate or not be a mask mandate in the state of Wisconsin. What we said was that if you're going to have a mask mandate, it has to be adopted in the proper way. Now, some people might think, well, why does that matter? If I like what the government has done, why do I care about how they do it? But the problem is that, we live in a country. Which is characterized by the rule of law. There are certain ways that we make law. There are certain ways that we command people to do certain things. And there are certain things that we should not want our public officials to be able to do. So for example, we argued that we didn't think that the governor should be able to grab emergency powers for consecutive 60-day periods, on and on and on and on and on, because during that period of time, he had extraordinary authority to make the law in a way which is inconsistent with our separation of powers. Here in the Becker case, our view is that if we're going to have the type of restrictions that were put in place by Madison, it can't simply be done by delegating to a public health official the authority to do basically anything he or she wants. Well, but what's important is the legislative body, the county board, endorse this so that we have maximum public participation in establishing the rules and restrictions under which we're going to live.
Well, here, you know, conservatives frame this litigation or this wave of legislating, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but, you know, as you look at this against public health agencies as a matter of individual liberties, do you worry about unintended consequences stretching far beyond a COVID pandemic to strip health departments of their longtime roles to keep us safe, like even having the authority to shut down a restaurant to keep our food safe? I mean, what are the unintended consequences here?
Well, so again, you have to be, you have to look at the particular case and the particular claims that are being made. Public health officials would still have the power to use existing standards that had been approved by the legislature to shut down restaurants if there was a problem with a restaurant. What we're talking about here is the extent to which public health officials acting unilaterally, without action by the legislature, without action by the local legislative body, in this case, the county board, can effectively make law, can effectively be deputized by the legislative body as lawmakers. This creates a problem which we often call non-delegation. Mm-hmm. This idea that we live in a system where legislative bodies make the law, executive agencies carry the law out. And we want these executive bodies, these public health officials, to have adequate direction going into a crisis, rather than simply tell them you can do whatever you want, because that arrogates too much power in the hands of a single individual and does not allow the type of public participation, which is very, very important, even when, and maybe perhaps especially when, we're faced with something particularly threatening and frightening.
Especially, but, you know, when time is something that you really are up against, that you have to make a change in a split second in order to make sure that you're saving.
Sure, there are provisions
there
are provisions for emergency actions, right?
Okay.
The governor can declare an emergency and act until the legislature can come into session. It's 60 days. The legislature can repeal it at any time. But that's not what happened here.
Mm-hmm.
What happened here is the governor declared 60 days emergency. When the 60-day emergency was over, he declared another one. When that was over, he declared another one. So that, as far as the governor was concerned, we were going to live under a perpetual state of emergency. We don't believe that that's what the law was designed to do. The law was designed for him to declare one emergency, get the legislature in there, and you know, fashion a set of policy responses that's appropriate to the circumstance. You shouldn't want the governor to be able to declare emergencies in series and then exercise or issue any order he wanted, because no matter how much you like Governor Evers, there will be a governor someday that you don't like as well.
Well, I do want to fit in our last case here, Rick Essenberg, president of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. I just want to, and I know we're short here in time, but John Doe et al. Versus Madison Metropolitan School District, parents represented by you challenging a Madison Metropolitan School District's gender identity guidance first adopted in 2018 for how to support transgender, non-binary, gender expansive students. What do you want the court to do here?
Well, what we want the court to do, what we want the Madison School District to do, is to respect the right of some parents. The district has essentially taken a position that anytime any child at any age expresses the desire to transition, that is treated as the final word, and the child is permitted to socially transition at school. Now, that may be the appropriate response in a particular case, but it may not be, because we know that most times, the huge percentage of times when children present with gender dysphoria, it desists over time.
But what about students who, you know, who are transitioning at school and their parents don't know yet?
Well, and that's the problem. Right? Madison is conspiring with these students.
This is guidance.
Yes, it is. It's conspiring with these students to lock their parents out of the decision making. Now, we typically don't do that with important medical decisions that children make. We trust, until until someone proves otherwise, we trust parents to know their children and to do what's best for them. And the case simply asks that the parents be involved, that the parents not be deceived by the school, and that this is, in fact, good health practice, because most of the time, these situations will desist over time. They will not persist. I mean, that's something that nobody wants to talk about, but that is an absolute medical fact. And so, having the parents involved, parents who know their child better than anyone else, is generally considered to be a good thing. It's considered to be a good thing in dealing with other types of you know, mental and physical health problems. It's a good thing in determining dealing with the discipline problems and academic problems, and it's a good thing here as well.
And Rick, we're out of time. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Rick Essenberg, founder, president, and general counsel for the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. News update is next here on the Ideas Network.